So, the last few weeks, we've been in Luke 9. We've seen the event of the feeding of the multitude. I want to take a moment here and kind of, retrace some of these steps, and in doing so, a little bit of I don't know, Bible geography, if you will. The event that happens there, the feeding of the 5,000, happens at Bethsaida. We see that in Luke. Now, if you don't know where that is, and I don't have a map up here for you, so you're gonna have to visualize. And if you have a study Bible, you should have a map in there probably somewhere. But you have Jerusalem right about here. Then up here is Galilee, right? So north of Jerusalem, and so you have this sea, and Bethsaida is on the north shore. Okay, so you're up here somewhere, right? And so this is where that event takes place. But then the very next passage that we read, there's that question that we explored for a while there. Who do they say I am, and who do you say I am? In fact, we're going to return to that passage, but in Matthew in just a minute here. But that happens at Caesarea Philippi, which is actually 25 miles further north. In fact, it's about as far away as you can get and still technically be in Israel, right? You're like in Israel proper, right? It's kind of like being at the edge of the 97374 zip code. Yeah, you're technically Sio, but let's face it, you're in Staten or you're in Jefferson, you're somewhere else, right? But technically, you're still here. So this is where that event takes place. I want to take a look for a moment here in Matthew. We've been in Luke, but I want to see Matthew's moment here because there's a few extra details. All right. So now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah," that is to say, Simon, son of Jonah, "for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. The gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. There's a couple reasons why I want to backtrack into this passage before we get into the next one in Luke. First, it's because of the actual place of this event. Like I said, this is technically Israel, but it's really so far out, you're not going to find a whole lot of Jewish people in Caesarea Philippi. In fact, you're not going to find any good Jewish people in Caesarea Philippi. It has become, well, it's become a pretty bad location. There's a lot that's going on here. In fact, this is, I always like to look at this as Jesus' youth pastor phase in his ministry, and he has just done the very thing that every youth pastor has done at some point in time, taking the kids someplace that they probably shouldn't have gone, right? Someplace that the parents are now going to question, because quite frankly, if I could steal a phrase, there's no more wretched hive of scum and villainy than Caesarea Philippi. It's bad. In fact, where he's standing is in an area that's known as Pan's Grotto. You'll know Pan as the Greek and Roman god. He's a faun, right? Half goat, half man. Usually plays a flute. Sometimes we kind of think of that. Don't picture Timbus, right? Narnia, right? That the same idea, but that's not who Pan is. Pan is not good. In fact, the worship of Pan, let's just say right now, this would be a not safe for work thing to describe some of the stuff that they would do in public to worship Pan, not even including the child sacrifices that took place. That's like the least of the stuff that would happen here. This place, Pan's Grotto, there was a cleft in the rock, and it was known as the Gates of Hades. So when Jesus says, "Not even the gates of hell will prevail," this is the location that he's in. This is the place This is the place that Jesus says he wants to build his church. Get as far away from Jerusalem as you can possibly get, and we get to this location, and this is the place that Jesus says, yep, here, here's a good one. This, I like this spot. Let's do this here. There's actually a couple different things that are taking place when Jesus says this. There's a couple of name changes, if you will. The big one that most people catch on is we have Simon, Simon Peter, right? But then suddenly he just refers to him as Peter. You're Peter. You're the rock. Petra is the word there. But the other change is this. Jesus uses the word church. Ecclesia, the people of God called out for a purpose. He isn't talking about Israel. He isn't talking about Hebrews. He isn't talking about Jewish. He's talking about my people. That's a change. Now, going back to this is where Jesus decides this is a good place for my church. This is the place I'm calling my people out to, Caesarea Philippi, a place like this. Now, typically, I don't know about you, and here we are. We're in Scio, also known as Mayberry, right? I mean, like, we're just a little town, and we got a little countryside church kind of a thing, and if you go around, drive around, you go out to Lyons, and you can go out to Gates, and you find little churches everywhere. Where do we usually find churches? We don't usually find churches planted in the middle of seedy districts. We find the nice neighborhoods and nice little places we can put it, but that's not exactly what Jesus is calling the church out to be. There's a bigger picture that's happening here. I think what we need to do is we also need to consider a couple other times that Jesus brings up this idea of where church is. And let's remind ourselves, when we say church, what are we talking about? Are we talking about necessarily a building? No, we're talking about where the people gather for the purpose of what? Well, it's worship. Right, we've talked about what worship is. It's not just singing, but it's declaring who God is. That's what worship is. So we have this moment where Jesus is in Samaria. Now, this Samaria is like smack dab in the middle of Israel, but yet Samaria is still not considered Israel. Right, like a good Israelites would not consider Samaria a place to be. Nonetheless, Jesus is having a conversation with a woman at a well, and she kind of debates. Well, some people say we're supposed to worship in Jerusalem, picks one location. But she says, meantime, though, we're here at Jacob's well. Certainly this has got to be the place to worship, is Jacob's well, the place, the very place that God gave Jacob. So which is it? And Jesus says, yes, no, both, and. Right? Like, there will come a point in time when worship will be elsewhere. It's not just Jerusalem. In fact, if we look at Jesus' ministry, that's what we see, is that it's not about one place, it's about people being spread out. So last week, we looked at what it means to carry your cross. And one of the conditions to carrying the cross is to follow Jesus. When we follow Jesus, what we find ourselves doing is we're not necessarily going where we want to go, but we go where he takes us, where he leads us. It's not about comfort. It's not about ease. In fact, if anything, what we learn in that passage is it's about rejection, right? Two sides of rejection. There's us rejecting the world and what the world offers, but at the same time understanding the moment we do that, the world in kind, if you will, turns around and rejects us. So to follow Jesus is to live in a life of rejection. Now, all too often what we see is people, I don't know how to say this the best way, when it comes to church ministry, doing the things that God has called, I think sometimes we see people try to mold, and I'm going to kind of keep it in general senses here, mold ministries around the culture. And I think there's argument here against that. All right, I've used the phrase often, what you win them with, you win them to. And that's really what I'm talking about. This isn't to say that there isn't a moment. I mean, Paul says it best, you know, to the Jew, I became a Jew. To the Greek, I became a Greek, as to win some. But that's not what we're talking about here. I'm saying where the ministry starts to reflect the culture rather than the gospel, to the point where you can't tell the difference anymore between what is church and what's, I don't know, Walmart. Right? There's branding that goes on, and sometimes that branding, it falls into the category when we say worship. There are certain churches, church organizations probably is the better way to put it, that they have completely surrounded themselves around their music, right? And many of those songs and whatnot, if you've been around here long enough now, you know that we don't even use those songs anymore because that's their entire identity. Right? They've branded their own worship. They've branded their own image to the point where it's about them. Like some of these songs, honestly, you can't tell the difference. It's that, this is my old man on the porch shaking my cane right now, right? You can't tell whether, are we singing about Jesus or are we singing about a boyfriend? Right? Like you can't tell the difference between the two. Or it's the song. What's the object of the song? The object of the song is the worshiper rather than the very thing that we should be worshiping. When the song's about me, it's no longer a song of, well, if it is a song of worship, it's idolatry. Let's just put it there. And the thing is, I'm sorry, and I know this will offend some, but man, anytime I walk, Wendy likes to have music playing all the time, and so I'll walk into the kitchen and like K-Love will be on or whatever, and I'm sorry, every time without fail, I don't know, maybe it's just my bad luck, my bad timing, but I walk in and I hear the song and I start listening to the lyrics and I go, who are they even worshiping? Because it's certainly not God. It's just a song about them and their struggle and oh poor them. Oh, but God's good. Like we'll slide that in. And that's what I mean here, right? It's creating Christian bubbles because Christian bubbles are safe, right? So, if I could, you know, using Christian music, if I could use one of my favorites, Steve Taylor, we get to the point where everything is Christian, right? And everything's a clone of it. And at the end of the day, I only shop at Christian stores and I only go to, I only eat at Chick-fil-A because that's the only one, except for on Sundays, can't do that. I get all my hobby stuff at Hobby Lobby I buy all my Hobby Lobby signs, right, that have Bible verses on them completely out of context. I saw a couple this last week. I thought about it and I thought, no, I'll just leave it there. I only drink milk from a Christian cow. Right, that's Steve Taylor's big one. I love that line. We're not supposed to mold our ministry around the culture, and we're not supposed to create a culture of a self. To follow Jesus, which the last time I checked, Jesus declares himself the, and we're talking definitive article here, the light. The last time I checked, light only works where it's darkest. To follow Jesus is to what? It's to be found in dark places. I don't know if that's good news to you or not, or if that's scary news. Last week I mentioned Jim Elliot. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose is the big statement. But I've read all of Jim's journals. And I'll tell you what, I've never read someone more enthusiastic about going places you don't want to go than reading Jim. Jim gave up his life. He lived what he said. He didn't go out to die, but where he went, he did. And quite frankly, if you don't know the Jim Elliot story, you need to know the Jim Elliot story. Go read Jim. Go read Elizabeth talking about Jim. Now, the second reason I bring up this, I come back to this passage is because, and this is probably more the real reason, is sometimes we take passages and we read a passage and we take it, are we holding on to our heresy for a moment here? Our heresy alarm or alert or spidey sense, whatever you want to call it. We take passages too literally. Oh, wait a minute, I thought we were supposed to take the Bible. Yes, we take the Bible literal, but we apply them in a literal sense the way that they were not intended to. It's important to understand, by the way, the writing style and the speaking style that we might see within the scripture. So in Matthew's passage here, this account, verse 18 and 19 specifically, there's some extra dialogue that we don't have in Luke, right? And this is this turning to Peter moment. Some will read this as to say that the church is built on Peter. It's not, okay? Rather than the passage being about Peter being the object of transformation, just as the church is to be an object of transformation, the people of God to be an object of transformation. But it's funny because there are those who will take it as this is about Peter. And it's not about Peter, it's about his church. Peter just happens to be the one who speaks up, so Jesus then uses Peter in this moment. Peter being transformed is as weird to be transformed. Now, I say this because what's interesting is there are people who have taken this to this literal place where this whole event is all about Peter and that the church is going to be built on Peter. We'll come back around to that. But what I find funny is what they don't do, what nobody seems to do, which you could do just as easy if we're going to take it as literal as possible, is this. We've relocated the church from Jerusalem to now Caesarea Philippi. Why do Christians make this pilgrimage to Jerusalem? Because they do. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But why do we, and we don't go to Caesarea Philippi, Syria, by the way. I don't see a whole lot of people racing to Syria to go worship Jesus at the moment, but I'll see a lot of people go to Jerusalem. Yet Jesus is actually in Caesarea Philippi. So if we're going to take this as literal as possible, then the church is only in one place, Caesarea Philippi. No, it's not what it's about, right? Again, we're talking about what does it mean to follow Jesus? And part of following Jesus, as we looked at that picking up the cross and everything, is part of that's denying yourself. And Jesus doesn't just ask us to deny ourselves. He demonstrates what denying ourselves means and what it looks like. Because after all, Jesus, God, took on flesh, emptying himself, Emmanuel, God with us. And in that process, by the way, he was rejected. He was rejected by his very own people. Go to Luke 9:22, as we did last week. But again, this passage being taken literally only would mean that it only applies to Peter or possibly Caesarea Philippi. And that does a couple of things that if we're not careful, we will do in our own lives in a practical sense. Here, in this case, it elevates Peter, doesn't it? If it's only about Peter. It elevates Peter to a greater status. And there are those. There are those within the Catholic Church who that's exactly, because Peter is the first pope in Catholic history because of this passage. The entire church is built on Peter. And I say that both figuratively and literally because it's understood that underneath the Vatican is where Peter is buried. So literally, the church is built on Peter. This is what happens when we take a passage and make it as literal as possible. By the way, you know what happens when we do this? When we say, oh, Jesus is just talking to Peter. You know what it does? It lets you and me off the hook. The church isn't about me, it's about Peter. See, it's about this bigger thing than me. I had a conversation some years back. It was after I had preached the Great Commission, you know, go make disciples. And the person said to me, I don't believe the Great Commission is for us. The way they said it at the time was, I believe it's only for the 12. Now, I had to correct them real quick to let them make sure they understood there was only 11 present at that moment. But nonetheless, they stood on that. They didn't believe that the Great Commission, what Jesus did was he sent out those guys. It's not up to me. Perhaps I should also point out that this person was an elder of a church at the time that they told me this. Such a misunderstanding and a missed opportunity. So when we elevate Peter, perhaps, to this particular place, we elevate the 11 up to this place, it lets us off the hook, doesn't it? I don't have to go do the things that Jesus says to go do, because he was talking to those guys, not to me. Then we get to where we left off with the passage last week. And so when I talk about the literal, what does the literal mean? So if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, right? And he goes through all these things. But verse 27, but I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. What is Jesus talking about here? Because last I checked, all those people standing there died. And I didn't see Jesus' return happening, because that's usually when we talk about the kingdom of God. Isn't that what we think? We think it's the second coming. It's, depending on your eschatology, it's the return. It's the establishment of the kingdom of God. This would be to say, by the way, if we were to take it that way, that Jesus just failed in a prophecy. He just failed in a prediction. He just failed in a promise. And last time I checked, and Luke has been dealing with this pretty heavily, Jesus as prophet and what that means. Last time I checked, when a prophet is wrong, they're not a prophet. So I guess that means Jesus isn't Jesus, because he just said these guys won't die, and well, they did die. In fact, not only do we see know the fact that they died, but if we go over to John's gospel, and we talked a little bit about this last week, there's that moment on the distant shore, and Jesus is like to Peter, do you love me? You know, the guy who he just, by the way, established the church, right? Do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Three times. And then he says, okay, so Peter, here's what you need to understand. You're going to die. You're going to die in a way that you don't want to die. And that's what it means to follow me. And Peter's response immediately is he looks over to John and says, well, what about him? And Jesus says to him right there, what? What if I say he's going to live forever? What difference does that make? Which then even the disciples at that moment start questioning each other. What does that mean? Like, they're trying to figure out, is he literal or is he figurative right then and there? Also, the humorous thing, the part that gets lost on a lot of people, is he's talking about John, and whose gospel is that account in? It's John's gospel. John's like, I know I'm not living forever. But yet, it's kind of funny that the guys thought I might. John has a lot of little bits of humor throughout his gospel that if you don't know, you miss. So did we miss something? I mean, what is Jesus talking about? And scholars have batted this around. Like, what does it mean? And I think most scholars have landed on the obvious, the easy. And I mean that in the right way, because sometimes we overcomplicate it. We try to think there's got to be some bigger, I don't know, metaphysical thing taking place here. Or maybe it's something a little bit simpler. I think it's important to understand something about Jesus. And when we read what Jesus says, we have to understand, well, how does Jesus talk? Because let's face it, he talks kind of unique, weird, a little Yoda-ish. Not necessarily, the words aren't necessarily backwards, but you're just kind of like going, I'm not sure if that was a statement or a question. Now, for us, and again, we're going to get a little metaphysical for just a second here. For us, we have a limited scope when it comes to time, right? I mean, for us, time is a linear construct. We can look back and we can try to either recall or read about what happened. But as far as the future goes, we don't know. And it's just a straight line, right? And somewhere in that line, you live and you die, and that's kind of it. Now, I think it's one of the reasons why the book of Revelation, John's Revelation, can be so discombobulating. Because John, a mere mortal this side of heaven at the time, is trying to describe in an orderly, linear fashion, if you will, all events happening all at once. Things now and things not yet. And trying to make sense of it as best as he possibly can, because the only instructions he was given at the time was, write this down. Luke's next recorded event, where we're going this morning, it lets us in. I think it lets us in on who and how verse 27 is true. Now, about 8 days after saying these things. So in other words, Jesus has said it. He's dropped it in their laps. And now they have marinated, if you will, in this for 8 days. Okay, so in other words, what we've had is it's been dropped. There's been a Sabbath moment. There's been this rest of this week. They're traveling. They're walking up and down 25 plus miles one way. And after these saying, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. And as he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. Questions. Who did Jesus take with him in this particular moment? He takes Peter and the sons of thunder, right? John and James. He doesn't take nine other disciples with him. He only takes these three. It's not the only time we see just these three pulled aside. This is the inner circle of Jesus' disciples. What did these three see? Well, they see Moses and they see Elijah. It doesn't say that they were struck with fear, but I kind of have a feeling there was a bit of awe at the moment. And what did they hear? They heard the kingdom. They heard the plan. They heard what is about to unfold and what it means. There's a lot of symbolism represented here in a very literal sense, right? You have Moses and you have Elijah. Moses represents, always represents. When we bring up Moses in the New Testament, we are talking about one thing and one thing only. We're talking about the law. And when we talk about Elijah, Elijah is the prophet of prophets. He is the prophet, right? And so when we have Moses standing there and we have Elijah standing there, we have the law and we have the prophets represented with Jesus. Now, remember when Jesus was asked that question, what's the greatest commandment? And what does he say? He gives a dual answer because Jesus never gives a single answer. He says, love God, love others. And then he turns around and says, and the entirety of the law and the prophets rest on this. To understand Israel is to understand the law and the prophets. To understand the whole purpose of the law and the prophets is to prepare the way of the kingdom. That's what they were always intended for. And now it's being seen by three of the 12. I think another way of saying that is it's being seen by some of them. Some of them, before they die, are seeing the kingdom in front of them. There's some other little details, and I've preached on these details before, but I love this passage because of these little things. And it's these little things that if you know moments. So in attendance is Moses. This is significant more than just simply that the law is represented. It's more significant than it's Moses right here, right? First off, that's kind of crazy all by itself. But what does it tell us in this moment? See, there's been some debates with Jesus and the religious leaders, and they seem to either go back to Moses or they go back to Abraham, but they never seem to get back all the way to the Father. They kind of just stop there. They stop with Abraham as father. They stop with Moses and the law. And they never seem to get to God the Father. When's the last time we see Moses? Not counting this passage here. Well, the last time we see him is just outside the promised land. And what is he doing outside the promised land? Well, he's taking care of God's people, and they all want some water, and there's been this time where he keeps striking a rock, and water comes from the rock, and it's all a good thing. And then they say, let's do that again. And God says, no, this time I want you to do it different. I want you to speak to the rock. Moses doesn't listen to God. He listens to the people. He gives the people what they want, and he strikes the rock. And then God does what? God takes Moses aside and says, it's done. You've disobeyed. And Moses dies. Moses is struck dead. But it's more than just that. Moses is then buried by God in an undisclosed place, just short of the promised land. He hasn't gone into the promised land. The promised land that he was promised by God to enter. This seems to be yet another moment where God's prediction, prophecy, promise is, well, it's unfulfilled. I mean, if we're going to say that the kingdom that he's talking about to the 12, that some will see before death, and we're like, well, how does that happen? And here, once again, Moses is promised to enter into the promised land, and yet he doesn't get to enter into the promised land because he disobeyed and he dies. That would mean that God rescinded his promise, that God is, dare I say, a liar? Or that God understands something bigger, arching time, because where do we see Moses standing right here, right now, in this particular story? He's in the very heart of the promised land. You can't get any more heart of the promised land than the mountain that he's on. Gee, Moses has entered the promised land, and he has entered the promised land through the promise of the Savior, who is Jesus. There's actually more practical sense of what's happening here also, especially when we look at it from the context of Luke's account. We have these two guys here, Moses and Elijah, the very two people that what? Just earlier when the question is asked, who do they say I am? And the answer is, some think you're Moses, some think you're Elijah. It's a little hard to be Moses or Elijah when Moses and Elijah are standing right there. It literally refutes the claims of the people. It clarifies for the three that are in presence that Jesus is not Moses. He is not Elijah. And this is important. The transfiguration is revealing Jesus. There's a transformation. Luke says an altered appearance. This isn't something that's coming from the outside, right? And changes kind of like it's demonstrating what's inside, who he is, who he always has been. And they're seeing him. They're seeing him the way that Isaiah, in Isaiah 6, stands at the throne and sees the triune God. They're seeing him this way. There's a moment where Moses himself, he comes off the mountain, and it says that he's radiating the glory of God. He's reflecting what they are seeing in this moment. They're seeing Jesus for who he is. They're seeing Jesus, the one who was and is and is to come. They're seeing Jesus, the now and the not yet. And as we can see in this story, there is some profound impact in this entire event on these three. Is there not in verse 32? What do we find? They were about to fall asleep. This incredible moment, and I don't want you to lose here, they were about to fall asleep. In fact, we find Peter sleeping through quite a few different events. This isn't, by the way, the last time that we'll see something like this happen, because they'll come to the garden, which is in the valley of this very mountain. And they'll come to the garden, and Jesus will say, stand guard, stay here, I'm going to go pray. And then 1 hour later, he comes back and he finds them asleep. He says, couldn't you stay awake for 1 hour? Now, actually, what happens in the second half, maybe that's where the pure astonishment comes in, or at least maybe it's an astonishment for the reader, because what is the response by Peter when he does wake up and realize what exactly is taking place here? Well, this is we need to do something. We need to build something. We need a monument. We can make an amusement park out of this. It's that moment in Jurassic Park when the lawyer looks around and realizes there's dinosaurs here. We can charge whatever we want to. Right? That's the event that's taking place. This is it. This is where we need to build. In fact, let's put the church here. That's what Peter's response is. Everybody needs to come here. We're going to build tents. Plural, by the way. So he's taking this one step above Old Testament, taking one step above David. Not one tent, not one tabernacle. We need three of them. And tents are dwelling places. That's what tent means. A portico, a shelter. We're going to create someplace for God, Jesus, and Moses, and Elijah, so everybody can come see the great attraction that is Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. This will be their dwelling place. Is this a new trinity of sorts? Now keep in mind, they just were in the location 8 days earlier where Jesus literally says, this is the kind of place I want my church. And Peter's response is, we should put it right here on this mountain. Let's just build it right here, right now. Has Peter lost the point? Probably. Is Peter excited? Always. To the point where literally Luke tells us he isn't even aware of what he's saying. He's that delirious in this moment. Don't lose that little detail there that Luke puts in. We could spend some time here this morning, can't we? Do we functionally do this in our own lives? Maybe there's an incredible event in your life. Maybe it's an event that we can say, oh, this is where God showed up, right? That phrase, God showed up. I've been on several different mission trips, and quite frankly, there's been moments where I'm like, this is going bad. This is not how it was designed. And then suddenly, if you will, God showed up, right? Something incredible happened that you just step back and you say, that definitely was not, that wasn't us. That was something else. We see people who will drive thousands of miles to go look at weeping statues or paintings. Or how about drive thousands of miles to go participate in quote-unquote revival events that are happening elsewhere? As if to say, it's not about revival where you're at, it's about where the revival, I got to go to the revival. Last time I checked, that's not how revival works, by the way. There's actually a phrase for this. It's called Christian tourism. And it's again, and I someday hope. I have many friends who have been sent on trips to Israel, you know, as pastors and whatnot. And it's a very enriching experience. And I would love to participate in such a thing. But at the same time, it's not about walking where Jesus walked. It's about finding the history, right? It's about saying, I've seen the sea. But it's not to go worship there because that's the only place to worship. There is a bit of irony, by the way, that's happening here. Is Peter wants to build a monument because going back to Moses, since Moses was present here, we go back to Moses and God makes a very deliberate decision to bury Moses outside of the camp, away from the people. The people don't know where Moses was buried. Do you know why? Because they never would have went to the promised land. They would have just stayed there. Or if nothing else, they'd make pilgrimages back to Moses' grave because that's what they do. That's what we do. We go back to monuments. That's not what we're called to do. But what's even more astounding, more surprising in this moment, it's what God the Father does. He actually interrupts Peter in verse 34. A literal translation. Peter, shut up. Stop talking. You're always talking. You talk too much. There's another point where God does this. God does it a couple of different times throughout the scripture. If you go over to Job 38, all this banter and talk about who God is, and you've got Job saying who God is, and you've got his wife saying who God is, and you've got his three friends who are lousy saying who God is, and then you got this other guy who kind of comes in and says, no, I'll tell you who God is, and then God says, why don't you all just stop and let me tell you who I am? Because you're all wrong. And it's exactly what God does here. There's a cloud. Where have we seen a cloud? We're talking about a cloud. We're talking about God. We've seen that in multiple places. In fact, go back to Moses once again. What did they follow? They followed a pillar of smoke. It's a cloud. Wherever the holy place was, there was a cloud. And anytime there's a description of God filling someplace, it's a cloud. And here, this is what's happening. And quite frankly, the picture is so incredibly beautiful. Because it's not about God in them, is it? It's about them being enveloped by God. And what does the Father say? Well, first he says, this is my Son. We've heard that before. Right? This is now the second time the Father has declared who this man is. But then there's the next part. The part that literally tells them to stop talking. This is my Son. Listen to him. Stop talking and listen. And who, by the way, is in the presence of? Well, James is there. And James would later on tell us, don't just be a hearer of the word, but a doer of the word. Because, see, the whole point of listening is that there is a call to do. But you don't know what to do until you listen. There's perhaps another similarity, since we're so close to Christmas, that we'd be ashamed to kind of miss, right? In fact, we heard a little bit of it in the devotional this morning. But you have Zechariah, John the Baptist's dad, right? He's a priest. Now, he's visited not by God, but by an angel. And in the midst of it, there is a bit of fear, and there's a big moment of silence. To the point where he's just going to have to be quiet for a while. And I think there's a bigger picture at play. And it's kind of, this is where I kind of want to circle around into. It's understanding to be in the presence of God, into this holy place, and it's to understand what it means to be still and to be silent. Because in that moment of still and silent, well, what does Psalm 46 tell us? It tells us this is how we know God. There's something about silence. I've shared some of these things before. When I was young, my first time ever going on a trip with Doug West, he says, hey, I want you to come with me on this. We're going to go visit a church. And I got into his car, and I was excited to be in the car with Doug because Doug understood my love for music, and he also understood my love for my kind of music, and I was going to inflict Doug with my music. I was very excited for this, only to get into the car to look to find not only was there no CD player, no tape deck, no radio, there was just an empty hole with wires sticking out of it, and my first response is, who stole your radio? He goes, no, I actually ripped it out. What do you mean you ripped it out? And he goes, it was too much of a distraction. I'm on the road. And during the rest of the year, not the 3 months of summer, Doug was the director of Camp Tadmore, my mentor. And so the 3 months of the summer, he's there, but the other 9 months, he's often traveling to churches to promote Tadmore. What he found was it was such a distraction for him. So he ripped it out so that he would spend the time in prayer, which, of course, in my young mind, I'm like, please tell me you pray with your eyes open because you're driving. But the whole point, though, is that it was a distraction. He needed the silence. I learned to practice silence at Tadmore. It's whether it be on the fishing dock or the one of the big rules back in my day. It's not this way anymore. In fact, it's far from it. But back in my day, there was no, you weren't allowed to have music playing at Tadmore just in general, right? Like if you're in a work vehicle or whatever, you couldn't have a boombox or whatever. For those who don't know a boombox, it's like a Bluetooth speaker with D-size batteries. So when you came into the camp, at the gate, music had to be off. And trust me, every single one of us, in our absolute defiance but obedience at the same time, literally had our hand on the dial, so when we hit the gate, it went off, but not a second sooner. I still do this today. I don't even have to. And I still do it today, because when I go onto the grounds of Tadmor, for me, that moment is, this is the silent moment. On my road trip this past summer, while there were moments I listened to some music and there were moments I listened to podcasts, there were also moments, especially, that I realized it was just noise. And I had to shut it off. I remember driving in particular on one back highway of in Texas, coming out of New Mexico, and it's just the most boring road in the world. The only thing moving were some windmills. I just turned it off. I had to. There's this moment with Elijah, right? And we know this story, but he's in a very desperate time. And he's in a cave, and God calls him out of the cave, and God shows him some pretty incredible events. There's an earthquake, and there's fire, and all of these things. But then there's that still small voice. That's where God was, in the silence. Now, while Peter's intention to build and proclaim, right, a message that would be of great acts of signs and wonders and a spectacle, instead, what he's told is to listen to the voice of the shepherd. And while it might seem antithetical to say sometimes that the gospel, you know, at the end of the day, the gospel is not for everyone. It sounds weird to say it that way, but the Bible's pretty clear. It's for those who have ears to hear. That's who it's for. Let he who has ears, let him hear. And the only way that happens is you got to stop talking sometimes and just listen. In fact, there's quite a bit of silence that takes place leading up to Jesus, isn't there? 400 years of silence. 400 years of people who could have been seeking God. And that silence, of course, it is broken eventually, right? It's broken by a host of angels. And who is this host of angels proclaiming to? Well, they're not broadcasting over a city. They haven't built a big monument on a mountain. Instead, they find some lonely shepherds out in a field. Now, see, I think there's a time we need to shut up and be silent. Is it okay to say shut up in church? I hope so. I think there's a time. There's a time to stop moving forward with your agenda. Stop trying to build tents and build God a bigger house. And the reason? Because there's something to be listened to. And I don't know about you, but as far as I go, I tend to be a very poor listener when all I'm doing is thinking about what's next. If I'm rushed into what's next, I'm not listening to what's now. So is that the lesson of the Transfiguration? No. No, it's really not. The lesson of the Transfiguration is the proclaiming of Jesus. It's his kingdom, his reign, his purpose, the plan of restoring all things unto and through and by and for him. That he stands not in opposition of the law or the prophets, but rather he is the fulfillment of what the law and the prophets have to say. And as we enter that promise, we understand we enter into this covenant. We see this covenant before us in the communion. It's being able to answer the very important question, who do you say I am? Because he's not Moses, he's greater than Moses. He's not Elijah, he's greater than Elijah. He is the Son of God, just as Peter answered. And now we see even the Father confirming. He is king. And by the way, he was king when he was in the manger, and he is king when he's on his throne. Now, if we could circle back around to silence just one more time. In the beginning It was silent. There was no need for words for God to know who he was and who he is and who he will be. But it is his voice that breaks that silence. Let there be. From the beginning, we're called to listen. See, we spent some time in Luke, and Luke has talked about and helped us understand the authority of Jesus. And with that authority comes, it becomes a worthiness to listen to Jesus. That same worthiness that answers not only the question, who do you say I am, but later another question that will be of similar value. Who is worthy to take the scroll? Who is worthy to break this seal? Maybe this is a good place to consider the context of Psalm 46, as we like Psalm 46, right? I mean, it's this, be still and know that I'm God. But do you know why we're to be still and know that he is God? Well, we have to read the whole psalm to get it. God is our refuge. That word, that's portico. It could also be later translated in the Greek as tent. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, that the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam. I got to pause here. What are we talking about here? This psalm is not about gentle streams and deers and whatever, right? This is about an event that hasn't taken place yet. This is talking about things that Jesus is talking about to come. It's not about peace and rainbows. It's about rough waters. It's not about floods. The waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. And by the way, that is not Jerusalem. This is a city above that. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. Or another translation, she will not be shaken. Now, we just got done saying the mountains are going to be moved, but his people will not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. Why should we listen to this Jesus? Because he utters his voice and the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. That's Emmanuel. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. Can I say that one more time? Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. And then these are the words of the Lord himself. Be still and know that I am God, the very one who caused all of those things. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. All the turmoil, all the commotion, be still. All of your holiday planning and your hustle and your bustle and your Black Friday deals and everything else, be still. Every Christmas we read from Max Lucado's God Came Near, and there's this whole picture of how Bethlehem is just abuzz with business, and they completely miss the fact that God has come to earth. Be still and know that he is God. In that moment, Jesus turns and tells the waves and the winds, be still. And they become still. Do you know why they become still? Because they know that he is God. Listen to him. Be still. I read all of this, and what do I hear? I hear once again those words that I said before. Someday this war is going to end. And in that moment, tears will be wiped away. In that moment, I think we'll finally learn what it means to be still. But see, until then, He actually still invites us to stop talking, stand in awe, in silence, be still. Jesus talks in a now and a not yet. What will be true is true. It's always true. It isn't about changing to something else. It's always true. So today, we both await the kingdom, and yet, behold, we live the kingdom. And his kingdom is a kingdom of hope. His kingdom is a kingdom of being still, because we know who he is. Peter tells us to be ready to give a reason for the hope that we have. It doesn't say go around shouting things and build tents and all. He learned somewhere along the line, you just need to be ready to speak. Don't have to always be speaking. In fact, maybe another way of saying it is this. We need to stop. We need to quit telling God and start listening to God. Pray. Father God, we do thank you. We thank you for the gift of your Son. And Father, we understand that in that gift, we also have the gift of reconciliation, to be restored, and to know that there comes a day that we will finally declare you as our God, and you will declare we as your people. And that's all there will be. But Father, even though that's a future event, may we live with that truth today. And as we come to this table, might we remember what has been done for us, that we might enter into this covenant promise that you will keep, just as you kept with Moses, just as you kept with Abraham and David, just as you kept after the garden with Adam and Eve. This promise of your Son. And if these promises have been kept, then we know the promise that is still to come has been kept. Help us to stop rushing around and be still and just simply know you are God. We give you all the praise and all the glory. Amen.
So it's what, December 3rd? It's beginning, people. We're in the season of chaos, and there's concerts and fundraisers and shopping and gatherings. And in all of that, our prayer for you is that you will find time, that you will make time, that you will fight for time to be still and know that he is God. Because that we're anticipating Christ coming. And it can be really easy to just, oh, Christ is here, and not spend it, having spent any time in the waiting. So, I don't know. Shut up. Am I allowed to say that? Do that. We love you. Have a good week.